These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, Black and Palestine, Continuities and Struggle. Africa World Now Project is next. What we are witnessing in this global moment is not unprecedented. It is European modernity coming apart, at it seems. The loosely tied myths that has kept it together are unraveling, delinking. But it intends not to go easily. The reverberating effect of its fits and fissures are being articulated in its violence. The contradictions are materialized through its human vessels like a virus seeing its inevitable demise. It is in the unity of struggle that we can inoculate the praxis of liberation to ensure this time, as with times we struggled and continue to struggle collectively against imperialism and its attendant colonialisms, chattel slavery, apartheid, etc., to follow in the tradition of resistance set before us. Today we look at a component of this unity of struggle. We pay attention to Black and Palestinian intersectional experiences with the violence of the colonial. When thinking about Black and Palestinian liberatory continuities, we have plenty to explore, but a good place we can find its most articulated expression is with Brother Malcolm. As far back as the late 1950s, Malcolm had been speaking out in transnational support of Palestinian liberation. According to Michael Fishback, several factors accounted for this. As a member of the Nation of Islam, Brother Malcolm felt a natural inclination to cultivate a kinship with other Muslims, including Arabs. Arabs had long been involved or in contact with the NOI, among them Jamil Shakur Diab, a Palestinian who immigrated to the United States in 1948 and taught Arabic at the NOI's University of Islam in Chicago. Of particular note in Malcolm's pro-Palestinian leanings were two visits he made to the Palestinians' homeland, where he first briefly toured Jordanian-controlled East Jerusalem in July 1959. During a subsequent trip to the Middle East in April and May 1964, he met in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, with Hajj Amin al-Husseini, who had been the preeminent political and religious leader of Palestine's Muslims during the period of the British Mandate. When Malcolm returned to the region a few months later for a lengthy stay in Cairo, he left the city for a two-day tour of Egyptian-controlled Gaza in September 1964. While there, Malcolm visited several Palestinian refugee camps, went to the ceasefire line with Israel, and held a press conference at the Palestinian Legislative Council building in Gaza City before carrying out his evening prayers at a mosque in the company of Gaza City's mayor. He returned to Cairo and attended a press conference given by the chair of the newly created Palestine Liberation Organization, after which he published a scathing critique of Zionism titled Zionist Logic in Cairo's English language newspaper, the Egyptian Gazette. Today, we explore Black and Palestine, its histories, challenges, and opportunities, with Ajamu Dillahunt and Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui. Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui is an assistant professor in the Department of History, Politics, and Social Justice at Winston-Salem State University. She has a PhD in American Studies and Ethnicity from the University of Southern California. She is currently working on her manuscript, Freedom is a Place, Black Self-Determination and Land-Based Struggles in the Low Country and Sea Islands. Her research covers the intersections of race, gender, power, spirituality, and geography, and explores how historically marginalized peoples and communities produce systems of knowledge, practice, and social movements. Dr. Siddiqui is also a valued member of the Africa World Now Project Collective, where she is a senior researcher and associate producer. Ajamu Amiri Dillahunt is a PhD student in the Department of History at Michigan State University. He is a member of Black Workers for Justice and a board member with the Interreligious Foundation of Community Organizations. He is also a former intern with the SNCC Digital Gateway Project at Duke University. In May of 2019, Ajamu graduated from North Carolina Central University, double majoring in history and political science. Ajamu also participated in the historic Demilitarized Durham to Palestine Coalition. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, and Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Listen intently, think deeply, act accordingly. Thank you guys for taking the time to join us today to talk about a very important topic that is in the news right now, but also has a longer genealogy, a longer historical genealogy than I think most people give credit to. But also there's a lot of misunderstanding, but a lot of confusion, a lot of things that I think that both of you will be able to provide our listeners, not only to think about, but also to contextualize one's particular place in this moment, because this moment that we're dealing with, particularly when we're talking about the atrocities and the violence that is happening in Palestine as we sit right now and how they relate to the Black historical experience, this is a moment of opportunity. This is a moment within which is a product of multiple moments, right? And so just to kick off this conversation that we want to have today is that, you know, I want to start with Ajamu. What are some of your thoughts of what's going on right now? You know, what's happening in the context of the Palestine and of the atrocities and the violence that is being inflicted consistently and continually on people, but it have exacerbated itself in this particular moment. What are some of your initial thoughts as we begin to unfold in this conversation?
Yeah, my initial thoughts are, you know, thanks for having me on the show first and foremost. But my initial thoughts is that is, you know, settler colonialism and Zionism and ethnic cleansing at play. And, you know, it comes as no surprise. It's inhumane. But in addition to the atrocities taking place and people being pushed off of their land, being killed by Israeli forces, people are fighting back. And, you know, they're not, you know, acquiescing and they're struggling in ways that they struggled since the occupation began. So it's an exciting time. And today in Raleigh, there's a Palestine solidarity rally taking place. And I have the opportunity to speak. And, you know, what I want to, you know, remind people is that this is a new era of struggle. This is a new moment of opportunity. And I remember being in Palestine and one of the co-founders of the BDS movement said, you know, the movement in the U.S. has a unique role in this struggle. Although, comrades in the U.S. may not be, you know, in Palestine, given the U.S. Supports the state of Israel and gives $3.8 billion a year, we do have an important role. So my initial thoughts, I'm just thinking about how do we really stand in solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Palestine and, you know, bring the empire down to its knees.
Dr. Siddiqui.
Thank you so much for having me. So just a kind of few reflections. This is a really important conversation that we're having right now. Like what we're witnessing, what is happening in occupied Palestine is really a reflection of the barbarism of Western civilization. We see the increased, and when we say increased, it's like, that's hard to say increased because, you know, we're also celebrating the Nebka, which is, you know, the dispossession and displacement in 1948 of indigenous Palestinians from their land, from being expelled from their homes, right? And so when we talk about the right of return for Palestinian people, this is the moment that marks that. So we see, and the Nebka literally means like disaster, catastrophe, where you saw 400 to 600 Palestinian villages that were destroyed. And so, you know, what we see right now, especially that sort of catalyzed this moment with the expulsion of Palestinian residents in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, what is part of East Jerusalem, which also plays off of this sort of, you know, Donald Trump claiming Jerusalem as the capital of Israel too. So we're seeing the aggressive and violent dispossession of Palestinians from their homes, going through one by one, like house by house. And I'm also thinking about Israel as you know, an illegitimate nation state, as all nation states are illegitimate. But, you know, it is really, you know, this strategic base, this colonial imperial outpost from which the West, so we're talking about Europe and America, can really wage its neo-imperial and neo-colonial wars against Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. So, you know, there's a lot, and we can talk about this as the conversation goes on, really, to think about, you know, this moment in 1948, as you're starting to see the partition, right, of indigenous lands, of Africans, of Asians, of the Middle East as well. And what this moment actually holds for us too is also this kind of continued resurgence that we saw in 2014, of these relationships of the anti-colonial, anti-imperial, decolonizing relationships between African people of African descent, with Palestinian liberation struggles, with the liberation struggles in Latin America, with the liberation struggles that are happening in East Asia and South Asia as well. So, you know, this is a moment which I hope we don't take this moment for granted and don't miss this opportunity to really start to kind of further catalyze our struggles against imperialism, neocolonialism, right? Against increased and permanent warfare as well. So, I mean, I'll stop there so we can kind of move through the conversation.
No, and this is what this is, right? It's a conversation too. And I would just want to make sure that I invite Jamu to, you know, to respond and, you know, to really have this conversation. But I really want to pull on this conceptual idea here, this notion of the colonial, this notion of the decolonial, but also in juxtaposition to the idea of a post-colonial. I think that this concept needs to be decolonized. Decolonization needs to be decolonized because, and it also relates to what you're saying, Dr. Siddiqui, this notion of a moment, this notion of a cyclical process of time that is repeating itself based upon the unanswered questions, but also a lot of the, failures, but also promises of what was being done before, which goes into my next question to kind of throw out to you guys. Can we talk a little bit about this concept, or can you respond to what I said in the context of Dr. Siddiqui just kind of eloquently, you know, really juxtapose or situated what's happening right now in this conceptual frame, this theoretical frame of decolonial, but I also want to kind of push on this notion of the post-colonial, and which also directly relates to the fallacy of a post-racial, right? So, Ajamu, can you respond to that particular statement in any way?
Yeah. So, in terms of, you know, the decolonial, the post-colonial, I mean, you know, the occupation of Palestine, like Dr. Siddiqui mentioned, is consistent with the colonial agenda that, you know, was taking place on the continent of Africa. Oftentimes, when I talk about Palestine or trying to introduce it, you know, I tell people, if you know about, you know, colonialism in Africa, settler colonialism in Africa, or the Berlin Conference, then you have some sort of understanding about what's taking place in Palestine. And so, you know, I think people think because, you know, the 20th century, you know, independence movements took place across the world, you know, and this idea of post-colonial, but in actuality, you know, colonialism still remained. But, you know, of course, it took a new form. But what's taking place in Palestine, what I think, you know, it's a consistent old fashioned, you know, 20th century, you know, prior type of colonialism that, you know, we really must take action on. And I think we're in a unique position, having engaged in, you know, years of struggle, whether it be, you know, independent movement, Africa, Latin America, on how people struggle, demands, you know, tactics adopted, envision, you know, for transformation, what was able to happen, what wasn't able to happen. And so I think we really must reflect on that and see, you know, how to really, you know, tackle, you know, Zionist forces and colonial forces as best as possible.
And that becomes important because Dr. Siddiqui, I obviously want you to respond to this, but I also want us to look at this in the context of the notion of solidarity as we kind of unwrap and unpack the history of Black solidarity or involvement with Palestine. Because again, the solidarity, but also the relationship between what's happening in Palestine, but also other ethnically and historically marginalized people directly relates to the conditions within which Africana people find themselves based on this notion of colonial, right? Based on this notion of fighting a colonial and a settler colonial force. But in particular, here in the United States, a lot of folk do not situate or do not find solidarity, particularly people of African descent, because they don't, but
the conceptualization of the issues in the United States for people of African descent is not looked at as mostly as a colonial problem, right? But most people, particularly those of critical and radical thinking folk, understand the conditions within which people here in the United States, particularly Africana people, people of African descent in the United States, is an internal colonial problem. Can you respond to that particular notion of that solidarity and how a segment of people of African descent here find that radical connections that is also a historical genealogy of which we're going to unpack in a few seconds here?
Sure. So I just wanted to actually also to remind folks, you know, like when we talk about colonialism, what is colonialism? And I'm like, and I'm thinking about and drawing from V.Y. Mudimbe's Invention of Africa. And so he really lays out like these complementary theses and actions that emerge when we think about colonialism, the domination of physical space, right? The reformation or colonization, right? Of what he calls native minds, the integration of local economic histories into the Western perspective, right? The elimination or reorganization of ancient modes of social organization. And also thinking about the ways in which, you know, we have had Black radical intellectuals, people like Harold Cruz, people like Jack O'Dell, people like Stokely Carmichael of, Kwame Ture, who have articulated the situation. And then I'm also thinking about Robert Allen's work, Black Awakening in Capitalist America, who have articulated the situation of Black people in the United States as a colonial situation. So Harold Cruz, you know, he's writing, you know, from the beginning of the of Black folks' experience in the Americas, we have existed as a colonial being, right? Our enslavement, our ancestors' enslavement had coincided with the colonial expansion of European powers. And it was nothing less than a condition of domestic colonialism here. So like as the United States is establishing colonial empires in Africa, in which, you know, Dr. Pope, you have written extensively about this too, in terms of, you know, you have American architects of the Berlin Conference. So as they are, you know, European powers are reorganizing their relationships in the African continent, what is happening in the United States? You have, you know, people of African descent that are fighting Jim Crow, you know, which we should rightly call as the modalities of Black genocide in the United States. You have America expanding its imperial project in the Caribbean, so in Haiti, in Cuba, in the Philippines as well, in Guam, right? And so those policies and practices that are getting worked out on Africans that are enslaved and then fighting that enslavement in the United States are also then being exported into, you know, these new imperial settler colonies in the Caribbean, in the continent as well too. So it's like, it's important for us to think about, you know, the ways in which those practices and policies are linked and then how our responses are organizing, right? Our analysis is articulating this relationship. I think there was a second part of your question and I got so caught up. I wanted to make sure that I attend to that second. What was the second part of the question, if you can remind me?
Oh, I forgot myself, but Ajabu, did you want to chime in here? Because I mean, you know, laying out this continuity becomes important before we really start to unpack the history of Black relationship with Palestine. And we're going to go through the different particular components and points of continuity, because that's very, very important, really, for our listeners, because there are some people who think, well, hey, you know, there are a segment of population, not us and not the folk that we deal with, which is a smaller population. But there are some people to think about, well, hey, that's something that's happening over there. That's something that's happening to the Palestinians. There's also people who talk about there's no relationship. You know, those are, you know, these notions of nationalism, these notions of Zionism, you know, are very, very important to unpack in this particular conversation, Ajamu. So could you respond to Dr. Siddiqui or add to or take the conversation in any direction? Because any direction we go in this conversation, we're going to end up back to the continuities, right? So go ahead.
Yeah, so I guess the around Zionism, I think it's important, and you know, for a more thorough understanding, I think, you know, Kwame Ture's you know, talk is on YouTube.
That great man, V.I. Lenin, at the turn of the century, wrote a book entitled Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism.
Is it Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism? Yes.
If one would read this little pamphlet, one would see here that Mr. Lenin had precisely pointed out that all of the world had already been conquered and divided by colonial powers. There was no else in the world left to be conquered or divided by colonial powers. This is the time when Zionism comes to rise. Zionism comes to look for a state when everywhere else in the world is already dominated. Thus, in order for Mr. Herzl to get a country for Zionists, what he did was to attach himself to imperialism, British imperialism in this case, quite specifically. Of course, as an African who suffered under the heels of British imperialism, I can have no love for it, and certainly I cannot love anyone who attaches themselves to it and attaches themselves to it for the foundation of a state and then call this a liberation movement. Liberation movements fight against imperialism, not with it. Clearly here. Yes. The legal foundation of the State of Israel is what is known as the Balfour Declaration. This declaration was issued in 1917. A man in the government of Britain named Balfour wrote a paper and promised the Jews a national home. The national home he promised them was an area which Britain was colonizing, Palestine. Palestine didn't belong to the British. Just like Ireland doesn't belong to the British, even though they have troops there. But here, these British imperialists signed a note and gave it to the Jews and they accepted it. Where is the morality for this? If you say that Israel belongs to you, then you don't go to a thief to get Israel, you go and take it. Once you go to an immoral being such as British imperialism, and this is the basis for you getting the land, then clearly here those who are truly liberation fighters must question this. The basis, we say, is the Balfour Declaration, and Zionists know it. The Zionism is certainly not a liberation movement because it never fought against any imperialism. As a matter of fact, today, Zionism is the baby, child, and infant protector of imperialism in the Middle East. It carries out the interests of American imperialism. As a matter of fact, Zionism and American imperialism is like this. If our tax dollars would stop giving money to Israel, the state would sink tomorrow. And certainly no one can deny that American imperialism is the leading imperialist nation in the world. So we cannot see how a liberation movement is so tied, string and ham to American imperialism. They work hand in hand with American imperialism. Thus they can hardly be a liberation movement. In addition to this, Zionism has nothing to do with anything religion, nothing. All religions are concerned with human beings after they die. That's what religions are for. Islam will tell you what happens to you when you die. As a matter of fact, this which forces you to live a good life so that after death you'll be able to enjoy the rewards of heaven. The same is true for Judaism. But Zionism says nothing about the individual after they're dead. They don't give a damn about you. The Zionism has nothing to do with religion at all. And one should not make the confusion here. The Palestinian state belongs to the Palestinian people. This is a fact.
On a basic level, Zionism, you know, the founders of it, the quote unquote conceptualizers of it, said it's a project built on expansion and, you know, the acquisition of land. And so Zionism openly, since its founding, was built on this project of you know, imperialism and exploitation. And so there's been a strong movement amongst, you know, people, whether it be Jewish Voice for Peace or whether it be Palestinian Youth Movement, the campaign, U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, to distinguish, you know, Zionism from Judaism. And I think, you know, Kwame does that in that talk too. But those are two different elements. You know, Zionism is at its core, you know, a colonial project, where Judaism is, you know, is a faith. And, you know, even at the State of Israel, it's widely known at its founding in 1948, a lot of, you know, Jewish people didn't identify with it, kind of separated themselves from Zionism as a form of moving forward. And so, yeah, I think, you know, that understanding of and difference between Zionism and Judaism is foundational. And when you make that point early on to people, especially for those who may not be conscious of, you know, or you know, being introduced into the struggle, that really, I think, sets the tone early on. And also with this, in terms of, you know, you mentioned people say that we're not connected, or, you know, it's happening over there, so it doesn't impact us. You know, in addition to the $3.8 billion that the U.S., you know, gives to the state of Israel, which is our tax dollars, there's also another pot of money from other U.S. agencies where it's like $2 to $3 billion, where it's military equipment, war-grade equipment, and things of that nature. But something that I think we'll get to later as we talk about the continuities in Black and Palestinian solidarity is police exchanges, is the police exchanges piece, which has presented a very important organizing tool. But the forces that are that have long brutalized and terrorized, you know, people of African descent in the U.S., indigenous people and, you know, other oppressed people are training and sharing tactics with those forces who are occupying, you know, Palestinian land, who are brutalizing and terrorizing, murdering, you know, Palestinian people. And so if that's not a connection, if that's not clear as day, then, you know, I'm not sure what is. And, you know, it's clear that people who avoid that, who ignore that, are intentionally doing it. The connections, the interconnectedness is there.
I wanted to just to kind of jump in though too, when we're talking about, you know, Zionism and you know, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture really articulates what Zionism is, but just to think about, you know, sort of the histories of Zionism, because, you know, Zionism is a reactionary nationalist response to these programs and massacres and hatred by European governments and European people. And it really comes out of this imperialist, old imperialist Europe. And it's a construct of secular European Jews. So the Zionist Congress, which is established in 1897 by Theodore Herzl, right? And then the idea was that, you know, to have the creation of a secular Jewish state in Palestine, right? Because they're, and we'll talk about these sort of like spurious claims that really, you know, historically don't actually bear out to the occupation and the claiming of Palestine as a Jewish homeland, but to go back to really the Balfour Declaration, right? And so the Balfour Declaration is this declaration that was really created to ensure British interests. But it's the first time that you see a European power that's officially backing the Zionist goal of making Palestine a homeland for the Jews. But what we see is in terms of like the Balfour Declaration, it comes out of a British imperialist policy because of, you know, and it comes out of the context of World War I, which is an imperialist war, right? Which you have the central powers that are trying to access more colonies, right? So you have Germany, committing, you know, massacres in Southern Africa, in Namibia. And so, you know, what the Balfour Declaration actually comes out of, it's this attempt by England to make sure, or by Britain, to make sure that Russia itself, right, doesn't actually withdraw from this war against the central power. So like the Ottoman Empire, Austria-Hungary, Germany. So it's making all of these sort of like secret agreements and deals and policies, not only with, you know, the Zionist Congress, or particularly, what's his name? Heinz Weizmann and the International sort of Zionist Committee, but also making, you know, these sort of deals with, you have Sheikh Hussein of the Hashemites, who, you know, and his son Sheikh Faisal, who are trying to drum up, you know, separation from the Ottoman Empire, trying to drum up Arab nationalism to get them to fight against the Ottomans, to sort of destabilize the hold that the Ottoman Empire has on these areas that Britain and France are trying to get access to as well. So the context of Israel even becoming an actual, having some sort of materiality, comes out of these wars of imperialism, comes out of these imperial treaties and pacts that are made by France and England, right? And to a certain extent, you know, America. So I just wanted to sort of kind of put that into a context when we're thinking about the Balfour Declaration, which then really becomes sort of this claim, this even though it's not a treaty or an argument, I'm sorry, or agreement, but it really becomes this declaration of support that the Zionist Commission really takes after World War I and starts to establish, because it's before 1948 that you start to see the establishment of settlements in Palestinian areas. And when you start to see them raising money, right, and buying or taking land, Palestinian land, right? And you also start to see these real violence against Palestinian communities in an area where you had, you know, you had indigenous Palestinian Jews that were living there. You had indigenous Palestinian Christians that were living there, right? You had a more sort of multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-racial society that was existing prior to this British mandate that gets, that really functions as the what initiates the establishment of the state in 1948.
Ajamu, Dr. Siddiqui has really laid out this historical context in the creation of the Jewish state and the creation, but also there's some points of continuity I want to highlight for our listeners that we will be getting into. So there's one particular point of continuity, the exploitation of differences is what I heard, particularly in what Dr. Siddiqui is saying, and also my own understanding of this particular history. But also clearly there's a land issue here, which is something that is consistently in the context of Black freedom movements as being an essential and fundamental component of Black liberation, right? Did you want to respond to anything before we kind of move into the explication or the unpacking of the Black historical experience or Black solidarity with Palestine?
Doc laid it out very well, thoroughly. So I don't think I have anything to add. Spot on. I took notes, you know.
Right, right. You and me both. Right. So, so was it? I also want to point out too is that when we're talking about the formation of this state, right? You know, this is 1948, correct? Also in 1948, we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. At the same time that this dispossession is happening, right, which goes into, and you know, I'm not going to throw my research, but actually I am. I'm going to talk about, you know, the contradictions of a universal declaration of human rights or a universality of human rights coming from a specific historical and philosophical experiences that is contradictory. Because at the same time that you have the dispossession of peoples, you have a world that is still colonized at this particular point. Then you have this Universal Declaration of Human Rights that is put out. At the same time, you have the formation of an illegitimate state, right? Which is also the same illegitimacy of the formation of the nation states on the continent of Africa as well. So having this particular historical foundations, and Dr. Siddiqui really laid out, you know, the historical foundations on the creation of this particular state, where it comes from and those types of things. Let's go ahead and start to unpack the histories of Black involvement, of Black solidarity and Black continuities with Palestine itself. So you can go ahead, Ajamu, and then Dr. Siddiqui will jump in right behind you.
You know, the relationship, you know, Black and Palestinian solidarity is of course, you know, you know, with Malcolm, you know, and, you know, when in 54, and he lays out, I mean, I guess one of his many critiques of the state of Israel is on, you know, Zionism. He criticizes Zionism. Of course, he travels there. But also within this context of Black and Palestinian solidarity, I think it is important to acknowledge or to have, you know, some sort of discussion about there's an element within, you know, the Black experience that supported the state of Israel. And I think, you know, somebody who we reference on the left a lot, and, you know, it pains me to say this, but, you know, A. Philip Randolph, you know, was very, very weak on the question of Palestine and supported Israel. And from, you know, Finchback's work, you know, Black Power in Palestine, he talks about some of the essays that, you know, Randolph wrote and, you know, all these different elements. So that's kind of some of the troubling, you know, troubling aspects of it that exist. But even though there's that opposition or that support for the state of Israel, I think the opposition to it within, you know, the Black tradition is still outweighs, you know, that minor, you know, support or engagement with it. So you have Malcolm, and then of course, you know, you have the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee who, you know, in 66 took a bold anti-war position and opposed the war in Vietnam. And then in 67, you know, followed up with a statement, you know, in support of Palestine. And then, you know, you had, you know, in the 70s, you know, the Black Panther Party. But another in addition to that kind of general history of, you know, the common understanding of these major groups, you know, well into the 80s, in the 90s, the early 2000s, there was still a strong relationship between the Black freedom struggle and the Palestinian, you know, liberation struggles. And so there wasn't any gaps. And, you know, oftentimes we jump to, you know, 2014 from, you know, we go from the Panthers and bam, 2014, but it's like, hold on, in the 80s, Jackson, you know, running a presidential campaign, talking about, you know, independent Palestinian state, you know, showing his, you know, solidarity with Palestine, having, I don't know, probably one of the best, you know, kind of, I guess, policy, Middle East, you know, policies than any other, you know, candidate that was running at that time. And so you had a pretty exciting type of momentum in the 80s. And then, of course, working class perspectives, you know, you had organizations who were organizing International Working Women's Day events and always had Palestinian women from South Africa, you know, Black women who were engaged in working class struggles within the United States, workplace struggles in the South. So, you know, this solidarity, I think, is more widespread than just the main groups, you know, that some mentioned. And then even, you know, North Carolina Central University, you know, people like to claim A&T, you know, started the sit-in movement, you know, February, you know, all that stuff. But, you know, it's documented that 1957 students from North Carolina Central, you know, University sat in at the Royal Ice Cream Parlor, but were unsuccessful. And they were led by a brother named Reverend Douglas Moore. And, you know, you all may be familiar with him, you know, the Black Political Convention in 72, you know, he was firm in support of Palestine, uncompromising, said that this, you know, this has to be a part of it. And so you had this element engaged in the sit-in movement, challenging segregation. And then, you know, by you at 72, you know, unapologetic about, you know, his support and uncompromising support for Palestinian freedom. And so this history is beautiful. And Finchback's work, Black Power in Palestine, I think is a good introduction to early years and some of, you know, the writings, the back and forth, even within SNCC, how they reached, you know, that position, some of the disagreements, how, you know, they may have lost funding, all those different elements are there. But, you know, the story is still being told and is still, you know, continuing today.
And I just wanted to kind of like add and maybe like fill in some stuff that, you know, Ajamu like beautifully laid out as well. So when we think about, you know, this long, and it's a long history of Africana and Palestinian solidarity. And I would even go back to, you know, the 12th century, right? So you have a large presence of an Afro-Palestinian population that lives in, you know, they even live in the African quarter in Jerusalem as well, which, you know, doesn't, and I would argue that this is the Black geographies, you know, in Jerusalem, that, you know, Afro-Palestinians themselves call that the African quarter. Everybody else doesn't call that the African quarter. But, you know, and so they were keepers of the Dome of the Rock, of Masjid al-Aqsa. And a lot of these Africans or peoples of African descent understand their history as related to Salahuddin in the 12th century. So those who were fighting these Europe's initiatory imperial and colonizing attempts through the Crusades, right? And so, and this is something that Cedric Robinson reminds us when he's talking about the transmutation of Africa, that the reintroduction, so to speak, of Europe to peoples of Africa and African descent is through the Crusades, is through this real contact with this multiracial, multi-ethnic, right, multi-religious Muslim empire, who in these armies that these crusaders are meeting with are Africans, are African warriors, generals. And so this image or this relationship between Africans and Palestinians, or Africans in the Middle East, right, really haunts the political imagination and the imagination of white supremacy till this day, right? I mean, like, these are the tropes that really get pulled on when we talk about, you know, we joke and talk about how we, you know, there's 14th century thinking. I'm like, we're talking about thinking that steeps back to the Middle Ages, right? So that is always animating the real anxieties of a white supremacist logic. So I wanted to go back to that because that's important. And that's also the ways in which these Afro-Palestinians really understand their relationship to Jerusalem, understand their relationship to indigeneity in Philistine. But to kind of fast forward and this history that Ajamu lays out. And when we think about going back to Malcolm X, who was a staunch opponent of Zionism, who wrote, as you know, you had on the show, Brother Obi Igbuna Jr., who reminds us that Malcolm was writing about the Palestinian question as he was in the NOI for Muhammad Speaks, right? And then, and he, you know, writes The Zionist Logic, which is an article that was published in the Egyptian Gazette in 1964. And he writes about the parallels between the subjugation of Palestinians and Africans. He points out the strategic value of Israel to the world imperialism. And he says, you know, like the ever scheming European imperialists placed Israel where she could geographically divide the Arab world and infiltrate and sow the seeds of dissension among African leaders and also divide the Africans against the Asian. And, you know, in 1964, Malcolm becomes one of the first African-American leaders or people of African descent, or I was going to say African-American leaders, that actually meets with the newly formed Palestinian Liberation Organization. And so when Ajamu is talking about, you know, this relationship in 1967 with SNCC and how they're coming out with this statement during the Six-Day War, you know, and it's really aggression on the side of Israel. And so they're pulling, they write this statement. Ethel Miner, who was a journalist who was very involved with organizing in Latin America, she was a member of the NOI. She becomes a secretary for the Organization of African American Unity with Malcolm X. She works with Malcolm X. She works with Kwame Ture, and SNCC publishes the Third World Roundup, the Palestinian Problem to Test Your Knowledge, which then describes Israel as a colonial state that's being backed by U.S. imperialism. And Palestinians being victims of the subjugation. And you can also see that they're already in relationship because this Third World Roundup is also pulled almost verbatim from this 1966 pamphlet that comes out of the Palestinian Research Center, Do You Know 20 Basic Facts About the Palestinian Problem, that was founded in 1965 and really like the research and media wing of the PLO. And this move and this push comes from 2 years of organizing and studying, right, that SNCC has internally. And so one of the strongest amongst the many different amazing radical organizing that SNCC does, one of its really strong important contributions to Black liberation movements was this area of education, was this rising of political consciousness and political awareness. And so, you know, you see these urban uprisings and urban rebellions that are happening in 1967. And that also gives rise for this, and some people call it a turn. I don't think it's a turn. I think it's a natural evolution of SNCC, but them coming out really as this revolutionary internationalist organization. And so then similarly, you also see with the Black Panther Party in 1960, you know, in its founding in 1966, as it goes through this evolution from being this local organization that's fighting police brutality and white supremacy in the police to addressing the issues of Black folks globally. And something that, you know, Daruba bin Wahad, who was a member of the Black Panther Party, one of our political prisoners, was part of the Black Liberation Army. He really maps out this relationship as he was involved, right? So the Black Panther Party then evolves as this revolutionary Pan-Africanist organization. And during that period, they're establishing concrete relationships with revolutionary movements around the world, especially liberation movements in Africa. And so they're meeting with, you know, revolutionary leaders, not only in Cuba, these delegates, these delegations that are happening in Cuba amongst Panthers that were exiled because of COINTELPRO, so people like Eldridge Cleaver, but also, you know, they're developing and establishing relationships when they're in Algiers, right? And so then they're in Algiers and they set up a Black Panther consulate in Algiers. And so they're in conversation, and this, you know, Algiers really becomes like this hotbed of liberation struggles. And so they're in conversation not only with the Popular Front of the Liberation of Palestine, so the PFLP, but also the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, then the NLF, the National Liberation Front of Vietnam, ANC, PAC, PIAGC, FRELIMO, the Congolese Liberation Forces, FLN. So you see, you know, the Black Panther Party is really offering as much aid as possible to these Palestinian liberation organizations through media, through propaganda. You also then see the relationship, you know, and we don't want to be American centric, but then you see this relationship of people of African descent in Cuba. So after in 1959, After the Cuban Revolution, you have Raul Castro and Che Guevara that go to Gaza, right? And are training, Palestinians in Gaza to fight guerrilla warfare against the Israelis. And we can go kind of extend this more, but this is such a robust movement, and we're talking about Black and Palestinian solidarity when we actually talk about what solidarity is, right? It's not just sort of like, you know, I'm going to make these sort of pronouncements on social media or go to a protest. It's about actually being like, I'm going to work with you. I'm going to travel to where you are. You're going to travel to where I am. I'm going to help you. You know, we're going to support each other in the best ways we possibly can. Given understanding is like, we're not working with a lot, right? So it's through our scarcity, even though there is the possibilities for abundance, but it's through our scarcity that we're actually starting to build these organizations. And in a lot of ways we are winning. And that's that becomes the issue. That's why you see such incredible, not only state repression, but international repression of these movements, right? Because they were successful in their organizing.
Doc, you were spot on. I mean, that was important context, you know, dating back, you know, to, you know, Afro-Palestinians, you know, to the 21st century. That was one heck of a history. And, you know, I guess to build on that some too.
And I just wanted to add, just as you're thinking, Ajamo, because I would be remiss, but also, you know, what comes out of this conversation, and hopefully Dr. Pope can kind of jump in this as well. In 1966, you see the creation of the Organization of Solidarity with the people of Asian, Europe, Africa, and Latin America, that, you know, it's coming out of Cuba and coming out of the Tricontinental Conference, you know, where you have people like Amilcar Cabral, who are also, you know, coming out and making the statements about solidarity with Palestinians. You also had this delegation of the Black Panther Party that goes to Beirut and is visiting Palestinian refugee camps in Beirut as well too. You have also the creation of a Palestinian Black Panther Party comprised of Palestinians that are emulating the work that the Black Panther Party was doing, not only in the United States, but then their evolution as a revolutionary Pan-Africanist internationalist organization as well. And so I think that those, you know, it's important to lay out that, you know, we're constantly have been in this internationalist framework. We've constantly been working, you know, exceeding, right, and exploding the parameters of the nation state, and also exceeding and exploding these ideas in terms of how we organize, how we think about how the political, right, and how we really think about viable alternatives to create that are not organized around colonialism or imperialism. So when we think about this politics of solidarity, you know, what, and something that Ajamo pointed out, you know, people like A. Philip Randolph or Bayard Rustin, right, who came out in support of an Israeli state, right, who are very much, you know, within that camp of a racial liberalism, right, that comes out of the context of, you know, really the violence of the Cold War and the ways in which the Cold War, anti-communism, which is anti-Black racism, really ideologically fractured and then actually physically fractured our movements. And so I think, you know, sort of one of these really important issues that when we think about is thinking about the ways in which we think about solidarity in terms of, you know, Black and Palestinian solidarity has always been about not necessarily thinking about the sort of shared past of oppression, but also thinking about this shared idea of what the type of world-making project that we're invested in, this shared idea of principles, this shared understanding of collective liberation. Like Palestinian liberation is very much connected to Black liberation, is very much connected to the liberation of Latin America, is very much connected to the liberation of Asia, is very much connected to the protection and preservation of the planet, right? So we also have to think about this level of ecological crisis that we're responding to as well, too. How we think about indigenous, right? When I talk about indigenous, I'm talking about African indigenous, First Nations indigenous, you know, indigenous to the Middle East, how we think about this indigenous knowledge systems in terms of how we relate to all life on the planet, how we represent ourselves here as, you know, stewards and custodians on the earth, how we walk lightly. And so these liberation movements are towards a more life-affirming, life-preserving principle and value and world-making system that reflects that.
Doctor, it came back to me when you were speaking, you know, as you were laying out, you know, the history about the Panthers, you know, and actually going there and, you know, SNCC, you know, all these different elements and the really unpacking the type of solidarity that took place. You know, earlier I mentioned the 1980s, but I also wanted to provide, you know, some, you know, specific examples about, you know, how the 1980s was a time period, you know, of revolutionary possibility and revolutionary struggle in general, especially on the continent of Africa. You know, our brother Thomas Sankara, he was, you know, in a lot of his speeches, he's talking about Palestine and uplifting the Palestinian struggle. And then, of course, our brother in Grenada, Maurice Bishop, and, you know, the New Jewel movement, they're also talking, you know, about Palestine. And then, of course, you have the anti-apartheid movement taking place, and Palestine is being inserted within that conversation, too. And so, you know, the 80s is representing a beautiful time period. And a lot of, you know, revolutionaries, you know, in the United States during that period, you know, were studying, you know, of course, you know, Cabral, you know, and Nkrumah, but also, you know, Sankara, you know, and Bishop, too. And so, you know, that time period represented, you know, a new phase, but a continuity in terms of that engagement in Palestine being a part of, you know, a revolutionary identity, a revolutionary movement, revolutionary future. And so, yeah, oftentimes, you know, when we talk about it today, too, you know, people say we need, you know, for the Palestine solidarity movement, you know, what took place, you know, with the anti-apartheid movement, that type of momentum, energy, you know, people not being able to, you know, not being able to avoid, you know, talking about it. And it seems like that moment, you know, right now, you know, we may be in that period where people have no choice but to talk about it. You know, Representative, you know, Tlaib, Cori Bush, you know, their talks on the, you know, on the floor, you know, while some, you know, might dismiss them, they were very powerful. And showing, you know, even if, you know, these, you know, elected officials who usually stay silent, especially, you know, Black ones, but for them to, you know, take this position, you know, on the floor, you know, publicly to the world and say, you know, we support Palestinian freedom is important. And also, you know, Cori Bush, Representative Bush, Congresswoman Bush, in her talk, she talks about, you know, a Palestinian brother who was part of the Ferguson uprising. And how he was bringing the question of Palestine there, but also just sacrificing for the Black freedom movement there. And so in terms of this continuity, you know, you see, you know, a lot of shifts and, you know, new potential for different types of solidarity. And we're at that moment right here, right now, where, you know, we can have a new type of solidarity, especially on the question of Black and Palestinian solidarity. And then even on the question of, you know, Afro-Palestinians, I know Mark Lamont Hill has been doing some work, you know, with Afro-Palestinians and, you know, has a documentary coming out. And then I just saw on Twitter that a brother who's a co-founder of the Dream Defenders, he's Palestinian. He was responsible and played a major role in Dream Defenders going to Palestine in 2014. They're coming out with a documentary, you know, 10 days, you know, I think in the Holy Land. So, you know, these documentaries are coming out, connections are being made. And, you know, hopefully I want to talk about, you know, in terms of campaign struggles, you know, of trying to, you know, fight, you know, the U.S. empire and, you know, the state of Israel. There's also some promising things there, building on that long, you know, tradition that goes back centuries, like Dr. Siddiqui laid out.
And I want to actually piggyback up on this particular point. I want to make this point, too, when we're talking about, you know, political officials, whether it's Cori Bush and these folk. I mean, having a statement on the floor is one thing, but making sure that these statements are connected with movements on the ground is something else. So while these, you know, we want to recognize them, but we don't want to situate them in what we're talking about in the context of this longer on the ground, people to people, community to community, solidarity that stretches back. Because one of the things that I was thinking when Dr. Siddiqui was making this point, we also have to talk about, you know, the point that she made, particularly with SNCC, we talk about the turn that they make, but that's not a turn, because the radical organizations, the people that are dealing with people and understanding how the same systems of oppression are the same oppressing Palestinians are the same global systems that was brought forth by European 14th century expansionism as a product of 10th through 13th century ideological and philosophical ways of understanding the world. And Dr. Siddiqui, I want you to talk about that a little bit more, because at the crux of these particular conflicts, again, it's the exacerbation of differences as erroneously and narrowly defined, but erroneously understood based upon these religious principles, cultural principles, that was something that was antithetical to a European understanding of their relationship with each other, but also the world, because we cannot talk about any of this without talking about those relationships, but also to really talk about the long genealogy. We can talk back, we could think back to the Southern Negro Youth Congress, those young people who had an internationalist view, who were dealing with folk from the Middle East, from India and other places, you know, having, you know, personal relationships with the, with some of the folk who actually started, you know, that particular organization. We can't talk about, you know, the relationship of Black solidarity. And again, we're talking about a particular form of solidarity. We're not talking about, again, as you said, Dr. Siddiqui and Ajamu, this platitude of just hashtagging, you know, and you know, kind of, you know, watching a speech or giving a certain, but you got the Council on African Affairs, who had a very clear understanding of an internationalist view. It is actually ahistorical for Black folk, particularly people of African descent, whether they're in the United States or in the Caribbean or in South America, to not have an internationalist view, to not have a understanding of themselves in relation to the global context. Because again, the systems within which we are fighting, as Sylvia Winter eloquently talks about, right, this moment, this 1492 moment that really, you know, exacerbates or institutionalizes these ideological principles of superiority that Europeans had within themselves, right? This was already embryonic, and this racism was already embryonic in the way that they understood themselves in relation to the world. So as the economy is developing, as they're moving out, they're discovering themselves through other people, but then calling other people other, right? So I think that that's important to talk. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, that moment, you know, that Cedric Robinson talks about, this moment of Europe discovering itself, because this is also in, you know, when we're talking about ethnic groups within Europe or as a product of Europe, this is also related directly to them discovering themselves, but also trying to attach themselves to a whiteness.
Sure. No. And I wanted to kind of like, something that Ajamu said, especially about the one of the co-founders of the Dream Defenders, because, and this was just kind of the earlier point that you had made, James, in terms of like, you know, we're thinking about, you know, the actual real relationships that people are creating on the ground, right? As opposed to thinking about, you know, these folks that are, you know, in this sort of ruling class or ruling elite, or this sort of political class. And one of the co-founders of the Dream Defenders, Ahmed Abu Zneid, you know, his father was actually a member of the PLO diplomatic corps that actually hosted at the time, Stokely Carmichael, in a solidarity delegation to the Middle East, right? And so you see like these continuities of these relationships. And once he understood that, you know, that relationship that his father had with SNCC, that his father had in terms of like these Black and Palestinian solidarity movements. So he's also then that inspired him more to draw on these historical legacies and to sort of revive or catalyze.
I met you in the club in Atlanta, Georgia. Said me and my homeboy were coming out with an album. You looked at me like, yeah.
Due to time constraint, you can listen to the entire program on Africa World Now Project's SoundCloud. Just search Africa World Nail Project.
Music by night just to pay for that dispute dance. To get your pants was a mission impossible.
That's it for Africa World Nail Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnailproject@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. Instagram at Africa World Now Project. Access to our other media platforms can be reached through the bios of our social media. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Muntali, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funa Ngonda, senior research content contributor and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior research content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, content contributor and filmmaker, Kurt Orderson, technology advisor, it's Byron Gray of Grayworks Technologies, and creative directors, international creative and artist designer Tabassum Siddiqui, and Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project can be heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University. Programs are archived and available on all podcast platforms. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent. Never said much, cause half of what he saw was so far from that place you wanna be. That word's hung up, lift it up more, follow me. Are you starting to gather what I'm getting at? Now if I'm losing you, tell me, then I double back. But keep in mind at the time, keep it real, what's the phrase? Silly one said now, but those were the days when spring break and Daytona and freak nicks made you wanna drop out of college and never go back. Move to the south, but that ain't a Kodak moment. On when myself and Big Boy, well, you knew what Miss Torn. That's right, you were around before the itch begun. Well, Torn had a daughter and Salter was made to mature before the first tour. We hit the road like Jack, laughed and cried and dropped it back with some yak. Girls used to say, y'all talk funny, y'all from the islands? Dot laughing, they just keep smiling. No, I'm from Atlanta, baby, he from Savannah, maybe. We should hook up and get toe up and then lay down. Hey, we gotta go because the bus is pulling out in 30 minutes. She's playing tennis, disturbing the tenants. 15 love, fit like glove. Description is like 15 doves in a jacuzzi catching the whole...